Support for the world comes from Hint Water, fruit-infused water with no calories and no sweeteners. Hint is available in over 25 flavors, including watermelon and pineapple water, in stores or delivered from drinkhint.com.
Hello, I'm Alana Gordon. I'm a reporter and producer at The World covering global health. Here at The World, we've been holding a weekly series of coronavirus conversations, presented jointly with The Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, taking your questions to the experts. This discussion series is featured on our Facebook page, but we wanted to share what we think are really valuable conversations with you here in The World's podcast feed. Last week, we had four panelists for a forum on food insecurity, inequality, and COVID-19. Joining me was Walter Willett, professor of epidemiology and nutrition at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and a professor of medicine at Harvard's Medical School, Sarah Bleich, professor of public health policy at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, Catherine Wotecki, distinguished institute professor with the Biocomplexity Institute at the University of Virginia and a professor of food science and human nutrition at Iowa State University. Catherine is also the former undersecretary for the USDA's Research, Education, and Economics Mission Area. And David Bunnell, manager of Food and Nature at the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. We started out the discussion with a short clip from the Los Angeles Food Bank to illustrate the pandemic's impact on Americans' food insecurity and the ways that organizations like food banks are helping.
The Los Angeles Regional Food Bank's mission is to mobilize resources to fight hunger in our community. The need in Los Angeles County before the pandemic was significant, with more than 2 million residents of our community needing food assistance. And because of the economic impact of the virus, we are seeing the need dramatically increase, potentially doubling, as we are seeing people who have never needed food assistance in the past needing the help of the Los Angeles Regional Food Bank. We are also providing nutritious food for our neighbors in need through emergency distributions so they can prepare well-balanced meals for themselves and their families. These drive-through distributions augment our agency network by providing large quantities of food to thousands of individuals and families who have been economically impacted by the crisis. Recent distributions range from 1,000 to 7,500 families served per distribution. Because the food bank leverages millions of pounds of donated food and thousands of volunteers, we can provide enough food for four meals for every dollar donated. With the support of the community, we can accomplish our vision that no one goes hungry in Los Angeles County. Together, we feed LA.
So we've just been watching about a clip about food banks, and I wanted to start with Walter. If you could tell us about how the pandemic is impacting food security, what is the big picture?
Sure. Thank you, Alana. First of all, I might note that not everyone in that clip was wearing a mask and keeping appropriate social distancing when those videos were filmed. Probably now they are, but I certainly hope so. Before we dig into this topic, we should mention what we mean by food insecurity. Briefly, this is assessed by a series of questions about having insufficient food or anxiety about having insufficient and healthy food. However, from one survey to another, the specific questions to define food security have varied, and thus the percentage of people considered to have food insecurity may be inconsistent across reports, and we'll probably hear a little more about that. Food insecurity itself is an unhealthy condition. Few things are as stressful as wondering about whether you'll be able to feed yourself or your family. Food insecurity is not only an issue of food quantity, but also diet quality, meaning a healthy, balanced diet. Diet quality is strongly related with disparities in income, education, and directly feeds into poor health, including obesity, diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, premature deaths, and many other adverse outcomes. In most US studies, people with food insecurity are on average more overweight or obese than food secure people. This paradox troubled me for many years, but now we have evidence that poor diet quality, meaning lots of cheap refined starches, sugar, and processed meats, is the recipe for obesity and diabetes. And unfortunately, that's what a lot of food insecure people can best afford. Also, deprivation or anxiety about insufficient food can lead to overeating when it is available, So now this all makes sense. Before the pandemic, the state of nutrition and health in America was already bad and getting worse. Obesity rates have been increasing in children and adults. Up to 42% of Americans are now obese. Rates of heart disease and many cancers have been increasing in younger generations, and life expectancy has gone down in the last 3 of the 4 years. The COVID epidemic has further unmasked the poor health status and consequences of insecurity in Americans. This has become very apparent because obesity, diabetes, hypertension, and heart disease are all related to risk of severe and fatal COVID. This has magnified income and racial disparities that already existed. For these reasons, simply going back to normal, quote normal, after the pandemic would not be a good outcome because we were already badly off track from a nutritional, environmental, and social justice perspective, and these are all connected. Among the many critical issues we need to deal with in the long term must be the dismal health and nutritional status of our country and the great inequities in health and nutritional status. Our discussion today is mainly focused on America, where we do have enough food, and the main issues are distribution and quality of that food. But in some parts of the world, especially where quantity of food was already inadequate or marginal, the COVID epidemic is adding a new stress, particularly in parts of Asia and Africa, and may precipitate serious famine. I'm glad that David Bonnell is with us today, and we'll discuss some of these global challenges.
Thank you, Walter. I want to move to Sarah now. I'm wondering, we just heard about the complexity of even defining what we're talking about when it comes to food and hunger security. Sarah, you've been looking at recent census data and other data that directly relates to this notion of food security. Building on what Walter's talked about, what are you learning?
Thanks, Alana. So I'll start with the census data. So many of you may know that one of the things the census has recently done, starting in the third week of April, is they've been fielding what's called the Household Pulse Survey. And that's a chance to understand for Americans, how are we faring with COVID-19? And included in that survey is a battery of questions asking about something called food insufficiency. So it's a narrower definition than what Walter just talked about. It doesn't include anxiety or resources. What it really looks at is what are people consuming and how affordable is the food that's around them. And so when you look at those numbers, the main takeaway is that prior, as you heard from Dr. Willett, prior to the start of COVID-19, food insecurity was quite high. It affected about 11% of U.S. households. Based on those census numbers, what we're seeing is that all states are showing an increase and that it has roughly doubled. So it's now at about 23% of households are experiencing food insecurity. Much like we saw prior to the start of COVID-19, where food insecurity clustered among Black and brown populations and low-income populations, we are seeing those same disparities persist now. So for example, prior to the start, food insecurity was at about 21% among Black households, 1 out of 5. Now that number is closer to 1 out of 3. And so then the question is, you know, what do we do about this? And there are a lot of proven policy approaches that can help address the problem of food insecurity. And I just want to offer you up one. And so there is a program called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which stands for SNAP. It's formerly known as food stamps. Prior to the start of COVID-19, it helped 38 million Americans afford food each month. About half of them were children. And it had a budget of about $68 billion per year. Now, since COVID-19 has started, not surprisingly, participation in the program has gone up. There are decades of evidence which suggests that participating in SNAP can effectively reduce food insecurity. So what has happened so far? So in the first few stimulus bills, there have been changes to the program that have done two main things. One is they've taken all families that were not already receiving the max benefit, which is $646 for a family of four in a month, and they've increased all families to that level. And the second is that for families who have children who would otherwise receive meals through the school lunch program, they are receiving those benefits through their SNAP card. So two really important changes. What has not happened is that the overall size of the benefit has not gone up. And that's important because it's widely recognized that the SNAP benefit in its current size is not adequate. So if you think about that family of four that's receiving about $646 per month on average, that averages to about $1.40 per person per meal. In 99% of US counties, that is not enough for a meal. And so included in the HEROES bill, which has passed the House and is sitting in the Senate, is a provision that would increase the overall size of the SNAP benefit by 15%. It's about $100 per month for a family of four. And so we'll have to keep our eyes on that and see if it passes. It is an effective way to try to meaningfully address the problem of food insecurity right now, which we know is an overall problem in the US and in many parts of the world. And in the US specifically, it clusters among Black and Brown and low-income populations.
And I just want to make sure I'm hearing correctly. One in three children in those populations now are reporting being food insecure.
So prior to the start of COVID-19, it was about one in six children were living in households were reporting being food insecure. Now that number is one in four.
Wow. More to talk about with that. I want to move to Kathy. Until now, many of us rarely thought about the supply chain, and that brings us food to our tables. How is COVID-19 revealing the weaknesses and cracks in that system?
That was actually a really good issue that you raised, Alana. And as Sarah just pointed out, the food supply chain for the neediest in our population, it's become quite obvious now that it's not meeting their needs. And the pandemic is also showing up that there are a lot of cracks in our food distribution, food supply chain, nationally and globally. And it's also made visible all of the interconnections that we have in the food supply. So one example is we import an enormous amount of food. Over half of our fresh fruits, about a third of the vegetables, over 90% of the seafood that we eat in the United States is imported. The fruits and vegetables from Central America and Mexico, the seafood from China and Thailand and Canada. Our food processing industry also is highly reliant on the importation of key ingredients that are used in processing. As well, we're also reliant for the health of our livestock on animal drugs that we import. And a lot of those ingredients and animal drugs also come from China. We also export a lot, and our economy relies on a healthy ag export market. We export soybeans and corn and beef and pork. And just this past week, some of my colleagues at Iowa State University predicted that those exports are going to be falling considerably in this year. We may have experienced nationally about a $50 billion loss to our economy from those exports. And in Iowa, the prices for production are currently below what farmers are going to expect as far as income when they bring those crops to market. So all of this interconnectedness and the importance of agricultural production to our economy also reflects policies over this last 50, 60 years that have really focused on the efficiency of production in the agri-food sector, countries producing what they do best. You know, for us from the Midwest, corn, soybeans, and meat products. And then we import the things that are more costly for us to produce. The pandemic has also pointed out that we have very important people who work in producing our food, the farmers, the farm labor, as well as people who work in the processing of those foods. And the closure of the meat processing plants due to big outbreaks of COVID is an example also of the vulnerability of that food processing system. Farm labor is so important that we've had exceptions in our immigration policy to allow the annual influx of farm labor, again from Mexico and Central America. And we've also seen some real visual pictures in the media of food that's being wasted. Farmers who can't get their fresh milk or their produce to market to meet the needs of people who really need that food. On a global level, some countries are putting protectionist policies back in place. So, you know, you can think there might be an emergence of more nationalism, food nationalism, with these protectionist policies at a time when trade could actually help to minimize the impacts of food shortages during the pandemic. So some countries, they tend to be smaller countries like Vietnam and Romania, but 17 of them in total around the world have banned food exports. And then some bigger countries like Russia, the world's biggest wheat exporter, had put in place limits April, May, June on the wheat that they export, which may have some longer term consequences. But so far, the outlook is that for food stocks, as well as for crop yields, U.S. and globally, that it's shaping up to be a pretty good year for agriculture production. And the hope is that a prospect for a food crisis like what happened in 2007-2008 with wheat prices spiking, that we hope can be avoided. But all of that is yet to be seen. So out of all of this, I think what's coming is some recognition in the U.S. As well as globally that we need to be building a much more resilient food system. We need to be building a food system that's health promoting, both for people and for the environment. We have a lot of opportunities with legislation to actually make those changes. So that's kind of what's happening on the food supply area.
Thank you. I just want to note we're having a bit of technical difficulties. And so David Bunnell is here to talk about some of the kind of global connections as well to expand on that. And we're hoping he'll be able to join with us soon to further reflect and provide insight on that aspect. Please forgive the noise coming from outside of my window that I can't control. I also just want to remind everyone that this is Facebook Live, and that brought by the Forum and Harvard School of Public Health, presented jointly with the World and PRX at WGBH. And viewers, you can post your questions on Facebook at the Forum, at Forum HSPH, and at PRI the World, or email them to the Forum at hsph.harvard.edu. So now that we've kind of heard some brief overviews, we want to kind of dig a little deeper and talk about some of the policy changes that you all have alluded to in terms of putting food on the table and those challenges, and how, as Kathy mentioned, one can create a more resilient food system. So I wanted to start with, actually, Walter, you started off this forum talking about how we have food, but then there's this difficulty in the connections. And yet we're also hearing from Kathy that at the same time, there are these now threats to supplies and within different communities and places. So I wonder if COVID-19 is kind of shaping or reshaping your way that you could see this kind of availability or access changing?
Yes, we're seeing major stresses on our food system at present. And again, I would like to go back to that this isn't a problem that just appeared out during the last 3 or 4 months of the pandemic. The reality was that there is a huge gap in diet quality in the United States. This isn't a problem of not enough calories. We have plenty of calories, but we have a measure of diet quality. We call it Alternative Healthy Eating Index. And in 2000, there was a large gap between low-income minority groups and upper-income white population in the United States. And after 2000, that gap doubled. So the disparities are getting worse, not better. And we can see that these disparities that start off in terms of income and education are connected directly with diet quality. diet quality is directly connected with obesity, diabetes, and then the consequences of obesity and diabetes are more heart disease, kidney failure, blindness, shorter life expectancy, and in the end, increased mortality. So all of these pieces are connected, and we really must do more to address the diet quality aspects here of what we, the economic and policies of this country directly influence diet quality, and also directly influence the sustainability of our agricultural system. We, as Dr. Ohtake mentioned, we really need to look deeply at those policies and readjust them. We're fortunate we have enough food, but the food that we make available to lower income groups in particular is generating and contributing to the epidemic of diabetes and cardiovascular disease. On the healthcare side, we also have issues that our healthcare system has been designed as a fee-for-service kind of enterprise, and that really puts low value in terms of prevention. In fact, that's a losing proposition when you get paid for people getting sick, not paid for keeping people healthy. There's some changes that we're pushing in a better direction under Obamacare, but we need to do a lot more in that direction. And fortunately, a number of my colleagues are realizing in these last few months that we do really need to look deeply at our healthcare system and make readjustments. But it's if we can't connect people with healthy food and make it affordable and available, we can give all the education and motivation that we want to. If it's not available and affordable, it won't work. So that comes back to the SNAP program to a major degree. And if we can't really adjust SNAP to pay, give more attention to quality of diet, making it affordable, available, it's not going to work. Fortunately, the Department of Agriculture has the WIC program, which does emphasize quality of food in addition to quantity. And so it's not a mystery. The Department of Agriculture knows how to do that. We just need to make that an essential component of SNAP.
And I do want to, Sarah, get to you to hear more about SNAP and also about some of the practicalities as well and what the current climate maybe has highlighted even more about some of the practical challenges and how people are getting food. But David, we're so happy that you're back. We hear that there's a storm, a rumbling, and that's created some challenges. I think that you're on mute, but if you can weather the storm, I just want to circle back around. Kathy had talked a little bit about kind of the broader global landscape of food supply chains and some of how exports and trade can actually help address food supplies and systems, and yet we're also seeing at the same time some more protectionist policies in places like Vietnam and Russia and so forth, if I'm capturing that correctly. So I just wanted to go back to you and offer you a chance to kind of help us better understand these global links to the food supply chains and what you can tell us about how the pandemic is impacting food security around the world while we all bookmark some of the really important domestic issues as well.
Well, Alana, thank you and everybody for listening. And thanks for your patience. Yes, we have a thunderstorm. I have a generator running outside. So with a tie and an Oxford shirt on, I've managed to get power to my little rural house. Well, briefly, the context setting is World Business Council for Sustainable Development is a membership organization of 200 of the world's largest companies. We're CEO-led, and about a third of those companies are directly focused on the food and ag sector. So WBCSD.org is full of information. I know I'm limited in time, but that's a great wealth, Alana, for listeners to go into to highlight some of the things I'll say. I mean, very briefly to touch on some of what you just asked, and Kathy, what I think I know you were going to say is this is a giant systems issue with giant systems failure, and the pandemic just highlight even more inequities here in the United States and around the world, highlight these things. And the staggering, I know some have been mentioned, but they really are truly systemic. 65% of farmers and farming families in the world are food insecure. I mean, just stop a moment and think of the sort of illogic of that. 65% of farmers and farming families are food insecure, and that stat is pre-pandemic. About 1.x billion tons of food is wasted every year at an economic loss of about $1.2 trillion. We actually have enough food to feed a planet of 9 billion right now, but we lose about a third of that. Great human and economic costs, of course. And then if food loss and waste were a country, it would be the third largest greenhouse gas emitter in the world. To tie in from an inequity, inequality, and system standpoint, the impacts on climate, nature, biodiversity, et cetera. So sort of staggering issues that have ripples all the way across the world, including in global value chains and supply chains. So Alana, let me stop there because I know I'm playing catch up and let you get back to where we were.
Sorry, I'm going to unmute myself, but there was a bit of noise in the background. I just want to kind of follow through on that thought, and then again, bookmarking, getting back to Sarah and the important domestic stuff. But Kathy, when you kind of left of having a more, looking at a more resilient food supply system domestically, and like how then, where are the windows then to kind of shift? Well, I want to go, David, maybe if you can build on this, because if as you look at businesses and this really stark paradox of farmers being insecure, food insecure, and at the same time, there's so much food for everyone. What are the ways that you and then maybe Kathy are looking at how to shift, or what are some examples?
These are such big, important questions. So a couple of things. When we talk about food systems at the World Business Council, we talk about everything involved in feeding people and animals. So big systemic issues across almost every economic system in the world, right? So everything involved in feeding animals and humans across the board, we call them value chains, and they're all interlinked. We published late last year, available again on WBCSD's website, the CEO Guide to Food System Transformation. It lays out seven specific pathways, Alana, that we feel business can help lead on. And I'll just highlight them and then shift back to Kathy, and I can build on these later in the program. First one is agricultural transformation, equitable value distribution. That begins to tackle issues around farming and farming families being insecure, among other things. Dietary shifts, we have other experts on the call better than me at that one, but as Walter knows, we work closely on that. Food loss and waste, it's already been mentioned. Transparency, obvious big one, policy and finance and new business models. So Alana, again, I can go in later in the program the ways that specific companies are tackling those, but that's sort of our path forward in trying to figure out how to feed the world a healthy, sustainable diet within planetary boundaries, and our focus is people, health, the planet, and balancing that out. So let's make sure I come back to give some specific examples, but I want to make sure Kathy has a chance to respond.
Yep, Kathy.
Thanks, Dave. Yeah, thanks. Well, I, you know, from a domestic perspective here in the U.S., the big opportunity that we have is the Farm Bill, the piece of legislation that Congress takes up every 5 years that covers just this huge range of issues related to agriculture and food in the U.S. So it reauthorizes the SNAP program that Sarah talked about. And it also just touches every part of U.S. agricultural production. So, you know, the opportunity that we have is next time it's up for reauthorization is in 2023. So, you know, just a little bit more than 2 years from now. But to think through each of the 12 titles within the Farm Bill and what kind of incentives can be built into those to bring our food system here in the U.S. into greater alignment with this vision that we've been putting together of a more health-oriented, more resilient, more sustainable food system. So, you know, one title relates to conservation. Within that are programs that provide incentives to farmers to adopt programs that are going to sequester carbon, you know, very important for long-term sustainability of food systems. It also has a title that relates to crop insurance. So what kind of changes can be made in crop insurance to provide incentives for farmers to be producing more of those fruits and vegetables Also, the commodity titles offer those kinds of opportunities. And there's also the research title, the one that I've been interested in over the years, about what, how can reorient our research programs to providing for American farmers, as well as for farmers around the world, some of the tools that they need to be economically sustainable in their own operations and producing that more health-promoting food supply. So my first recommendation was, let's focus on the upcoming farm bill and what kind of incentives can we put in there to start moving the food system in the directions we want it to go.
At the same time that you mentioned that's in 2023, but you know, we're in a pandemic right now, and that's also illuminating some of these challenges now. So I wonder, actually, Sarah, going back to you, when you're thinking about stimulus bill, when you're thinking about SNAP programs right now, what are some of the most urgent things that you see? And at the same time, I wonder how that relates to even eating patterns and practicalities of when you put these things in practice.
Yeah, so I think as we think about the stimulus bills, one of their primary functions is, how do you help people get through this period? And a big piece of that is, how do you help people eat, and how do you help people afford things like rent? And so that's a big role of the stimulus checks we've seen in the various bills. And so what's clear is that there has been rapid progress in the first three stimulus bills, which Congress pushed out, and now things are stalling a little bit. And so we've talked a little bit about some of the key areas of progress in the earlier stimulus bills, and they are important. So, you know, people are getting more benefits through the SNAP program. People who have children who would be eligible for school meals are getting about $114 per kid per month for a period of time to help feed those kids because schools are closed and they can't get food that way. But you know, there are lots of rules associated with these programs, and it's sort of where the rubber hits the road. And it's these rules that can make it complicated to do the things we want to do with legislation, which is, how do you reduce food insecurity in meaningful ways, particularly amongst the people who are hurt the most? And so to give listeners a concrete example, right now, what schools are doing in a lot of ways is they're administering their programs using the summer food service program. And what's tricky is that most school districts administer meals over the course of the year, and they don't have experience using that summer food service program model. Only about 16% of schools have that experience. And so schools are having to rapidly adapt to this new set of rules to feed children meals during this period. And so what that means, for example, is that there have been waivers that say, if you're a parent, you can go pick up multiple meals for your children, which is a great thing. However, every single component of the meals, based on rules, has to be packaged separately. So that means if you have one child and you're picking up meals over the course of a week, you might have five little containers of milk and five little packages of sandwiches. And so it creates lots of inefficiencies for schools then to adhere to the rules and get the food into the hands of the families that need them. And there are other practical realities around social distancing and staff members getting sick and having to shut down sites. And so I think, big picture, there has been a lot of heroism on the part of schools to try to get the food to the families that need it. There have been a lot of efforts by Congress to try to create changes to the programs like SNAP, like school lunch, like WIC, to help low-income families, but it simply hasn't been sufficient. And that's where the fourth stimulus bill, the HEROES bill, has an important role to play in trying to expand some of these existing programs and expand some of the provisions that have already been passed in prior stimulus bills. Because the sad reality of this situation is, because we went into COVID-19 with massive disparities, those disparities, as you heard from Dr. Willett, are getting wider. And if we don't try to stop them, it's only going to get worse. And then the recovery period for low-income and minority communities is going to be that much longer.
Walter, I wonder, going back to you, we kind of kicked off this part of the discussion looking at the whole thing, looking at food banks and the role of food banks, but also, do you see changes in food patterns or moments where something like how these kind of problems are coming into greater focus, you could see ways or shifts in improving diets in this moment as well? So that was kind of two things packed into one.
Yeah, so starting with...
Right. Or, yeah, could have Walter weigh in and Sarah too. Go ahead. Right. Yeah.
Yes, diet quality, as we talked about, is enormously important. we actually don't really have a good real-time measure of diet quality. We're trying to integrate that into some of the national and local state surveys that are being done at this point, but we're not actually sure about what's happening. I think we, again, need to do urgent things that Sarah has talked about in the long run. As Kathy also mentioned, we need to look at deep system issues that a lot of it relate to economic incentives and disincentives. There are some really fundamental issues about what food we produce and eat, and then how do we produce it. And both of those have a demand side and a production side. We can't just produce a whole lot more healthy food and assume that people are going to eat it. The producers always say, well, if people demand it or want it, we'll produce it. But often it's at higher cost, not affordable, not familiar. So a lot of our work in the long run does have to be on education, working with food services to put healthy, attractive, delicious food on the table to increase the demand side for healthier food. Then we also have to have incentives to produce it. But price does pay a lot. That does make a lot of difference there. And we've done some studies just reducing the price of salads. People buy more. In terms of what kind of direction we need to go, fundamentally, we do need to move toward a more plant-based diet, not necessarily vegan diets for everybody. But, I hate to say it, I'm from the Midwest too, but what goes on in Iowa is a really dysfunctional food system because we've used massive productions of corn and soy, mostly to feed animals. 90% of the grains produced in this country are not eaten by humans. And we feed them to hogs and cattle, and eating too much of those makes us ill. And in the production process, we are having adverse effects on the environment. Those are fixable. And having incentives in the right direction will help. Farmers are doing it this way because the incentives make it work for them. They're not making a lot of money. They're often scraping by. And changing the price incentives to, like Dr. Wojtecki said, to be paid for sequestering carbon would help the way we produce food enormously to make it affordable and even profitable for farmers to do the right thing. Making healthy foods more affordable, more available, again, working on the demand side. With always education is fundamental but not sufficient. We need to address this from several different directions.
So, Sarah, I know that you are eager to chime in. I want to go to you and then expand this out more globally and go to David as well.
Yes, I think one key point for listeners is when we think about why people eat what they eat, there are three main drivers. It's price, it's convenience, and it's taste. And in that census household pulse survey, affordability was the number one reason why people were reporting being food insecure. And so if we want to address this problem, food has to be affordable and people have to have money to be able to purchase it. The other thing that's happening right now in the backdrop is, and this is part of the clip at the beginning that you saw, is there is a large charitable food network that is completely overtaxed right now. And that is a combination of lots of people needing help. And it's also a combination of immigrant families who don't feel comfortable reaching out to the existing nutrition assistance programs because of the current administration's posture around various immigration policies like public charge, which can deny a path to citizenship for different programs, including SNAP. And what that means is that many people are reaching out to the charitable food network, which is relatively small compared to the broader food system and simply doesn't have the resources to meet all the needs. And there are no nutrition standards there. So even with the best of intentions, there's a long way to go to sort of having the food that's made available through the charitable food network be of good nutrition quality for people that need to address problems around hunger.
And when you expand that out, David, to kind of global nutrition, I know you bookmarked earlier in the conversation about some examples, but kind of building off of the conversation now, I wonder if you could weigh in on how you take that to a global perspective.
Yeah, I'm actually inspired by the Los Angeles Food Bank video. We can sort of stay on LA thematically in a minute, but we bridged first to Africa. There's a project called the Farm to Market Alliance, and our members, Syngenta, Yara, Bayer, and Rabobank, are involved in that, along with the World Food Program and AGRA, an African-based association. And that's a really interesting concept, looking at the idea of farmers markets and local markets and helping connect them directly to local supply chains and food chains. Now, that may seem obvious for those of us that are involved in markets or have been privileged enough to connect through to them. But your farmers market in an affluent suburb is a very different experience, or has typically been a very different experience than those that otherwise don't have access to them. So if we bridge to Los Angeles for a minute, the Urban and Environmental Policy Institute at Occidental College, that's my son Ryder, who's active in it. It's a really interesting farmers market program. Sarah, you probably have been leading in this space. Walter, maybe you too. Kathy, maybe you also. Looking at farmers markets as a potential intervention in desert areas and areas of food insecurity, and taking it, you know, to the next level, enabling those things to be created and to thrive, but also making sure that SNAP, WIC, and other opportunities are there to help people fund the purchase of high quality foods. So two examples there. Other examples are companies like Danone that have done really interesting work, particularly in the middle of the pandemic, putting about $250 million into 13,000 small businesses that support their value chain. Unilever, another member, again, in the middle of the pandemic, that's $100 million of soap, disinfectant products and food into developing countries. And I think about $500 million of cash flow relief to their suppliers, many of whom are not big like a Unilever. So just a couple of examples, Alana, of where sort of interesting interventions, maybe the right or wrong use of that word on the farmer market side, I find interesting. And also some of our companies that are looking at how do we sort of do some relief and resilience as part of the pandemic. And then two other things I'll mention, the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance, for our listeners, amazing video called 30 Harvests. We have about 30 harvests left before we have to feed 9 billion people. Really interesting to watch. And then Wolf's Neck Center for Agriculture and the Environment here in Maine has an amazing project called Open Teams. So Alana, that ought to keep our listeners busy for a while, looking up some of those ideas.
I want to, Kathy, go back to you. Walter had mentioned some pretty big challenges to kind of how food systems work in the U.S. and the Midwest. And I wonder, in this moment, as well as being really interested in kind of the research and innovation side, how you see that changing, or what you make of kind of the, especially with like the meat systems right now in the United States that have been brought into greater focus during this pandemic.
Yeah, well, there is an enormous amount of energy right now and discussion that's going on about how do we build sustainable agricultural production systems, you know, not just in the U.S., but globally. And what role does that question of efficiency that I raised earlier, that's kind of informed our policies, what does that play as we look forward to building these sustainable food systems? So to the points about, you know, what we do in the United States, yes, we produce a lot of livestock and we export quite a bit, pork as well as beef and others, but we can produce it very efficiently. And compared with the environmental impact of our agricultural livestock production systems, it's relatively low, still an important part of our overall environmental footprint, but compared to agricultural production systems in other parts of the world, it's something that we're doing pretty efficiently, pretty well. So if we envision a food system that remains interconnected with countries producing what they do best, it might be part of our long-range plans to continue to produce livestock for meat consumption here as well as for meat export, but to continue to do that in a way that's going to minimize what its overall environmental footprint is. If we choose to go to a more resilient food production system, that would entail us being less dependent on imports of, you know, fruits, vegetables, fish. That means dramatic changes in our agricultural production systems, and particularly for fruits and vegetables with the quality aspects that we want, big environmental impacts that go with them, fertilizer use, pesticide use. So it's not just a really simple pivot that can be done to produce a sustainable system. And like I said, there's a lot of energy in around these discussions, as well as a lot of research that's ongoing and still needs to be done. And then I also wanted to emphasize a point that David just made, and that is that the private sector also has a big role to play in this envisioning of the future directions for the food systems, and a whole lot of innovations from the farmers markets that he was talking about up all the way through to production systems where we're producing food inside buildings, you know, urban agriculture, vertical agriculture, goes by a lot of different names. But, you know, there are all these other possibilities that are starting to trend now and taking off. So the food system is enormously complex nationally and globally. And as we're moving, hoping to move towards more sustainable, healthy food systems, there's a lot of different ways that this conversation can go. It's not just one simple solution.
I want to get to some questions from viewers, but first, thinking about David talking about this notion of food deserts in communities and some of the solutions you're looking at, I actually want to go back to Sarah a little bit and have you kind of, I know there was a point that you had also wanted to bring back to when it comes to this notion of food deserts. I know that's a term that can mean a few different things in the United States or around the world in terms of what that actually looks like.
Yeah, so if we think about food insecurity, it's important to think about it in the context of this idea called a food desert. And so that is helping us understand how far people from the closest supermarket. And so if you define that as in an urban area, you're about a half mile away from the closest supermarket, and in a rural area, you're about 10 miles away from the closest supermarket, there are about 54 million Americans that live in food deserts. And you can just practically think about, if you're far away from food, that can make your food insecurity worse, particularly now when social distancing and transportation challenges due to COVID-19 can make it hard to move around cities. And then when you add on to this, what we've also saw around the police, the protests against police brutality related to the murder of George Floyd, in parts of the country, there have been areas where food retail outlets have either closed down temporarily, like say a Target might have closed, but there have also been cases of vandalism where stores have actually been closed permanently. So in some parts of the Twin Cities, there are neighborhoods where the only supermarket now no longer exists. And so as we think broadly about, you know, how do we solve the problem of food insecurity, there are long-term challenges, but there are also short-term challenges around sort of food justice. Do people have access to food? And what can we do immediately to try to bridge that gap? Because this is something that is an immediate need, as Alana started off the conversation pointing out. It's not something that we can wait 5 years to fix. We have to think now and long-term, what are the practical things that are getting in the way of people actually feeding themselves right now?
So I wanna go to some questions. This one comes from Julia, and I think Sarah might be good for you to take the first part of this, which is, could you talk about the impact of coronavirus, of the current food challenges on immigrants and people who are undocumented? And from that, I don't want to, I'm curious also then, Kathy, if you might be able to talk about the worker aspect to a lot of the food systems that comprised of immigrants. When I think about the meatpacking plants, as you mentioned earlier, also in farming.
Yeah, thanks, Alana. So I'm going to try to answer this briefly in the hope of getting to more questions. But essentially what is happening right now is there has been a chilling effect on a lot of people who are immigrants in using programs for which they are eligible. So an example of that is there's a provision in the Family First Act called Pandemic EBT. And what that's doing is it's saying if you have a child in the school system, immigrant or not, and that child receives free or reduced meals, you can instead receive that money in the form of a SNAP card. However, the public charge rule, which has been currently paused, the public charge rule, which was brought by the Trump administration, says that if you participate in social safety net programs, including SNAP, it can deny a path to citizenship. Even though it has been made clear that you can participate in this program at no potential hurt to yourself, there's a lot of fear among the immigrant community that if they choose to participate, they will not be able to become citizens of this country. And so there are hundreds of thousands of immigrants who therefore are not taking advantage of these programs. And that then is further straining the charitable food network.
And from the food production system and processing system, we're highly reliant on immigrants. In the meatpacking industry, for example, the vast majority of the workforce are immigrants. Our annual food production system is highly reliant on short-term labor that comes in under visas to work in agricultural production and to follow the season when crops are being picked up the East Coast and the West Coast. So we have a food system that has been and continues to be highly reliant on immigrants, both short-term and long-term.
How do you address some of the issues that we've seen when it comes to people being more at risk for contracting coronavirus, like on the job, and some of the protections that may or may not be there?
I think you're referring to the outbreaks that have occurred in the meat industry in the United States. And that has really, I think, put into stark focus in the public's mind what the conditions are like working in these facilities. They appear to be ones that are actually maximizing the potential for the spread of the virus, because people are working in very close to one another. It's a very noisy environment. So if you speak to someone, you have to shout to be heard. So they may be spreading the virus by speaking very loudly and shouting. It's cold, which also seems to lengthen the viability of the virus. So the circumstances have been ones that have all come together to create a situation where an outbreak of COVID-19 is likely in these processing facilities, and it has happened. And that then has shown up the weaknesses in the actual worker health protections that the federal agency that we have, OSHA, that is established for its express purpose of occupational safety and health, has not put forward regulations that are putting into place the recommendations, requirements that there be social distancing and protections for workers. And the Food Safety and Inspection Service at the Department of Agriculture, that has the oversight for the safety of the meat supply, has also not stepped forward and really tried to protect its workers, the inspectors that are working in the plants, or worked closely with OSHA to provide protection both for the inspectors as well as for the workers. So I think this is really, the epidemic has shown up, you know, what the working conditions are like in the meat industry, and also the lack of protections for workers in the meat industry or in similar industries.
So I want to move to Walter for this next question from Ben. We only have a few more minutes, so we're also moving towards wrapping up. But how you feel COVID will impact food insecurity and inequality in the next 10 years? Because I'm hearing both a lot of really dire projections, but also potential policy moments and opportunities. So Walter, how do you see this further impacting situation?
It's hard to predict, but I think we are at a crossroads here. If we really are aware and think deeply and care about these issues, it's an opportunity to make fundamental improvements that will improve health, well-being, and sustainability over the next decade. But if we just, once we get over this, and we will at some point, we have acute urgent issues we need to deal with. If we then just go back to the way things were, the inequalities will likely be worse. So I think we are at a crossroads here, and we need to put tremendous effort into thinking about this and acting.
What about David? How do you weigh in on that?
Well, I'll tie this in, knowing we only have a couple of minutes left, with a bit of sort of closing thought. One, I want to bridge back to a couple of minutes ago. Kathy and you were having an interaction about what I might call sort of COVID-19 response for employees and workers and companies. And again, on the WBCSD website, we have a whole project on COVID-19 response. You can see some really interesting things companies are doing to address worker health, supply chain health, et cetera. And then, Alana, I'd say sort of the parting idea is, you know, what I'm watching companies within WBCSD's network do are sort of five specific things, and I'm going to make sure I cover them all. I'll make it brief. Focusing on making a difference right now and being tangible. This is not a time to greenwash, whitewash, rainbow wash, whatever color washing you want. It's got to be real. It's got to be now, and it's got to be immediate to solve problems. Two, close the trust gap by increasing integrity and dependability. Now is the time to truly build on number one. That is, do what you're going to say and follow through. Appeal to individuals, not the masses. We use words like consumers. These are human beings, each with specific issues, and we have different regional and local issues. Sarah's highlighted a number of them brilliantly. Fourth, it's really a time to partner. Number 17 of the Sustainable Development Goals, they're all important, might be one of the most important. It's around partnerships. And recognize that trust is the sum of many parts. It is going to take truly a village to solve these big system issues. That sort of information is available again on our website from a report done by Edelman and WBCSD. So Alana, I'd mention it because I know you wanted us to do some closing themes. So back to you.
Thank you for that. We just have a couple more minutes. I wonder if Kathy and then Sarah and then Walter, if you might just offer up your final takeaways.
Sure, Alana. I think my final takeaway is a call to action. I think folks need to get involved in food policy. Almost every governor has a food policy committee. You could be on that. See one, you know, that the mayor in your town establishes a food policy committee, but I think it's time that people get involved now that we've seen all of these cracks. Let's do something about it.
All right, Sarah.
And I would say, you know, the tragedy of COVID-19 is obviously the massive human toll, the unemployment that has in part led to record numbers of just hungry people in this country. But because hunger is now so mainstream as a result of COVID-19, it creates a lot of policy opportunities. And I think that this is a chance for policymakers to leverage the proven tools that we have that we can bring to bear that will meaningfully address the problem of food insecurity and at the same time help to decrease some of these really large gaps that we have in terms of the haves and the have-nots.
And Walter?
I would echo those. I think we have acute issues that we need to deal with very urgently here. And we also at the same time need to look at long-term solutions. And I agree with both Sarah and Kathy that this is a time for action, looking at, again, both the long-term as well as the acute emergencies that we have. There is a pathway to a future that is better for everybody, both from a health standpoint and creating an environment that is sustainable in the long run. And this is an opportunity to really move forward in that direction.
That was Walter Willett professor of epidemiology and nutrition at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and a professor of medicine at Harvard's Medical School, Sarah Bleich, professor of public health policy at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, Catherine Wotecki, distinguished institute professor with the Biocomplexity Institute at the University of Virginia, a professor of food science and human nutrition at Iowa State University, as well as the former undersecretary for the USDA's Research, Education, and Economics Mission Area, and David Bunnell, manager of Food and Nature at the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. This Q&A was jointly presented by the Forum at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and us here at The World. You can find the video of this discussion on our Facebook pages at Forum HSPH and at PRI The World, and see more from the series at theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. Thanks for listening.
From PRX.